Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here in Los Angeles, and I want to thank the organizers at the symposium for doing such a nice job. I'm going to be talking today, as Dr. Goins said, about the interface between borderline personality disorder and medical illnesses. This talk will have a remarkably different flavor to it than the talk you just heard from John. This talk is based on the work mostly of Mary Zanarini. You've heard her name, and you'll hear her talk a bit later on this afternoon. Mary's been organizing the MSAD, which you may have heard about, and this talk is based on results from that study. MSAD is the first NIMH-funded prospective study of the longitudinal course of BPD, and I think it's the largest prospective study of borderline patients. We've been working with these subjects for about 12 years now. We have 362 McLean inpatients, and we follow them quite intensively every 2 years. We've just about finished our 10-year wave, and we'll be starting our 12-year wave. Actually, this slide is a bit old. We've started our 12-year wave. Now, we have 290 patients who meet criteria for BPD, and 72 access to control subjects. Now, we had noted clinically that some of our own patients seemed to have pretty poor physical health. This isn't something that there's much literature on. Jean Beckham had looked at PTSD among Vietnam combat veterans and found that they had poorer physical health than did other people. Lisa Dixon in Baltimore has done a lot of work with physical health and schizophrenia and found, again, something which probably won't surprise you, that patients with schizophrenia have distinctly poorer physical health than do other people. Now, unfortunately, we didn't think about this at the beginning of the study, so we don't have a lot of baseline information. But starting at 6-year follow-up and continuing, we've been gathering a fair amount of a history. And we're interested, again, in three aspects: their actual medical health, lifestyle choices that these subjects make, which has an impact on their medical health, and utilization of medical services. So we devised an interview to try to capture this information, the medical history and services utilization interview. And we administer this interview to our subjects, and we also ask them about the health of their first-degree relatives. And this, we'll discuss all of this as the talk goes on. Now, at 6-year follow-up, we've lost a few subjects, although not very many. We started with 290 borderline subjects. We now have 264. And at the time of this follow-up, the subjects have begun to separate. And as you can see, we have 200 remitted borderline subjects and 64 non-remitted. We also have 63 access to comparison subjects. And we did the usual statistical magic to get some good results. First of all, the comparison between BPD and OPD, our borderline subjects and our other subjects, turns out not to be quite as interesting as the next comparison. And remember, we have, by 6 years of this study, we have a clear distinction, the non-remitted borderline subjects and the remitted subjects. The non-remitted subjects are significantly older, but this is it's a bit of a statistical significance. I don't know that that's clinically very important. What is important, and try to remember this, is that these subjects are still very young. They're in their early 30s, okay? It's a bit of a homogeneous group. Both groups, more than 75% female and more than 80% white. This reflects where McLean is. Okay, so this is what we'll be talking about for the rest of my talk, the difference between the non-remitted borderline subjects, that is the subjects who still have a lot of borderline symptoms, and the remitted subjects who are doing much better. First of all, we looked at a syndrome-like condition. This may be a bit mysterious, but the syndrome is what we defined as either temporomandibular syndrome, that is people who have pain over their temporal areas, chronic fatigue, or fibromyalgia. These are three rather, again, mysterious syndromes, not well understood and anecdotally linked to borderline personality disorder. And we found that a quarter of our remitted borderline subjects had this, but significantly more of our non-remitted subjects did, over 40%. And this is all of the next few slides will be significantly different. So the non-remitted subjects had more of these odd syndromes, the TMJ, chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia. Now here's a key slide. This is BMI, body mass index. I really want to emphasize this slide. This is a key slide. Body mass index is one of the ways to measure obesity. If you want to measure obesity, you can't really just measure people's weight because you have to take into account their height. So body mass index is kilograms divided by meters squared, and over 30 is the commonly accepted definition of obesity. Now, all of us know that there's a bit of an epidemic in obesity in the United States today, and so this was something that we really wanted to look at. Now, John mentioned Girl Interrupted, and that's a bit of a cliche of how we think of some borderline subjects as young, waif-like Winona Ryder girls who are very, very slight, very frail, very thin. But he also, thank goodness, mentioned Tony Soprano, who is not waif-like at all. And in fact, when we looked at our subjects, the non-remitted subjects, 40% of them have a body mass index that meets the definition of obesity. The remitted borderline subjects, the subjects who are doing better with respect to their borderline symptoms, are not as many of them are as obese. We'll come back to this finding again and again. Osteoarthritis. And again, I want to remind you that we're talking about young people here. These are youngsters. They're in their early 30s. Osteoarthritis, we think of that as connected with older people, and in fact, 17% of the non-remitted subjects have that, more than the remitted subjects do. Diabetes, this is another key slide. Highlight this in your book. This is, we combine diabetes 1 and diabetes 2. Again, we're having an epidemic of this in the United States for all sorts of reasons, connected, of course, with obesity, may be connected, unfortunately, with some of the medications we're using. And again, this is a young group of people. Almost 11% of our subjects have diabetes. Now, Dr. Goen mentioned that I work at Bedford Hospital. I work at the Bedford VA Hospital, and a lot of my patients have diabetes. Some of my patients have borderline personality disorder, too, and this is a combination that's challenging to treat. If you've got insulin-dependent diabetes, you need insulin. And insulin, unfortunately, is something that you can really overdose on. And probably most of the clinicians here are unfortunately familiar with that situation, a person who overdoses on their insulin. You can also use it, unfortunately. I left the hospital on Thursday, and as I was leaving, one of my patients said to me that he needed to talk to me tomorrow. And I said, "I'm sorry, I'm going to be away." And he said, "Again?" He said, "Boy, you have one cushy job, don't you? You're never here. When you're here, you ignore me. You're always going away on fancy vacations." I said, "Well, I didn't really know what to say, and I probably just said, well." And he said, "By the way, I'm not taking my insulin anymore, and I'm going to eat exactly what I want. Hope you have a good time, Doc." So diabetes, it's a very, very complicated illness to have. And unfortunately, in this slide anyway, it does seem to be associated with borderline subjects who are not getting well. As some of us know, diabetes is probably also associated with an earlier onset of dementia. And again, many of us have seen subjects whose blood sugars are very high or very low, and this distinctly affects their mental status. So it's extremely difficult, for example, to work in therapy if your blood sugar is all over the place. So this is a whopping complication to have if you've got borderline personality disorder. And we sometimes do that, perhaps, with some of our subjects if we use atypical antipsychotics, because there's probably an association with diabetes with them. So this is a very unfortunate, very complicated finding. Hypertension or high blood pressure, again, this is associated with obesity, and again, this is a young group of people, but we're seeing more hypertension than we otherwise would expect, and more in the non-remitted borderlines. Chronic back pain. Chronic back pain turns out to be common in the population at large, again, connected with old age and with obesity, and yet we see 62%, that's really almost two-thirds of our patients, our subjects, non-remitted BPD, have complaints of chronic back pain. Urinary incontinence. I don't exactly know why we asked this, but I'm glad we did. This is a subject that is very difficult for young people to put up with. It obviously has an impact on how you feel about yourself, about your social interactions, and our borderline subjects who are still borderline don't need any more problems, and yet they tend to have urinary incontinence more often than the remitted borderlines. Putting this all together, this is just a graphic showing that if you combine medical conditions, the remitted borderlines have fewer chronic medical conditions than do the non-remitted. This is not fair, but this is how it is. Now, remember, there are three parts to this talk: the medical conditions, the lifestyle choices, and the actual medical utilization. So let's move on to lifestyle choices. One of the most obvious is smoking. Surely most of us know now that smoking is not good, but there we have it. More than half of our non-remitted subjects are still smoking, less than half of the remitted. Rather a high figure, I think, for both subjects. But this is going to show up in medical complications fairly soon. Alcohol. Now, alcohol is a bit complicated because small, regular amounts of alcohol may, in fact, be somewhat healthy. But these are people who are drinking alcohol on at least a daily basis and binging, too, although I don't have those figures for you. But again, more of our non-remitted subjects drink on at least a daily basis than do the remitted subjects. And again, alcohol, if you drink too much, obviously a risk factor for many medical illnesses, and certainly doesn't help you gain control over your life, work in therapy, form good relationships if you're drinking this amount. Now, lack of regular exercise. This is another major topic, because it turns out that exercise is perhaps one of the best things, apart from picking good genes, but once you've picked your parents, the next best thing to do, that was a joke, the next best thing you can do for your health is to exercise regularly. And this is lack of regular exercise. For those of us who have calculators with us, the other way of looking at it is that 53% of the remitted subjects exercise regularly and only 33% of the non-remitted subjects exercise. Now, exercise is obviously good for our health in just a myriad of ways. It also may be one of the best antidepressant agents we have. Gallenberg's Abstracts of Psychiatry just reviewed this a couple of weeks ago, and it's a difficult subject to study, but it seems the regular exercise may have a very good maintenance effect in treating depression. The problem, obviously, is that if you're depressed, the last thing in the world you want to do is go out and jog. But if you can somehow be forced to do that, exercise seems to be a good antidepressant, and of course it's good in so many other ways for physical health. Daily use of sleep medication. This is sort of a barometer that I think George Valiant first came up with as measuring health in a number of ways. Remitted borderline subjects, Almost a quarter of our admitted borderline subjects have daily use of sleep medication, and well over a half of our non-remitted subjects. Overuse of pain medication. Remember, we had earlier slides looking at osteoarthritis and chronic back pain. Much higher in the non-remitted subjects, so is the overuse of pain medication. And this is certainly something I see in my practice at the VA. Not unusual to admit borderline subjects on quite large amounts of OxyContin. And that, of course, causes all sorts of psychiatric and medical problems. Okay, so again, putting these together in a graphic, if you're lucky enough to have remitted from your BPD, that's associated with the ability to make good lifestyle choices. If you're unlucky enough to still have borderline symptomatology, it goes along with making a number of lifestyle choices that are not so good for your physical health. Now, the consequences of having poor health are obvious. You suffer, you feel unwell. But I guess in an election campaign, the other consequence is medical care costs are higher. Now, medical costs are a little bit complicated because they both are related to your medical illness and also perhaps some degree of help-seeking behavior. So this may be a little bit more complicated than it looks. We talked mostly about chronic medical conditions being more common in the non-remitted BPDs, but acute medical conditions seem to be also. Now, there's so many acute medical conditions, it was difficult to study them, but what we did do was ask our subjects about emergency room visits. And this is not for overdoses or psychiatric problems, and it's not for pregnancy-related problems, but just going to the emergency room for a medical problem, an acute illness or an accident. And the non-remitted BPD subjects, within the last year, 80% of them had made ER visits. Seems to me a lot, and of course, this is expensive. Also, our remitted borderline subjects were in the emergency rooms pretty often also. Medical hospitalizations, again, this is not related to borderline in itself, and it's not related to pregnancy, but 40% of our non-remitted subjects had a medical hospitalization in the 2 years previous to this interview. Again, this is an expensive way to live. It reflects probably a myriad of factors. Again, here's a graphic showing that the remitted subjects have fewer ER visits or hospitalizations compared to the non-remitted subjects. Now, John had talked about heritability. And so we had collected family data. We wanted to look at the difference between our non-remitted and remitted BPD subjects in terms of the physical health of their families. This, again, is complicated because we don't entirely know if we're looking at nature or nurture or gene or environment. But for what it's worth, here's some complicated data. Syndrome-like condition in family, again, this is TMJ, chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia, more common in the non-remitted, in the families, this is the first degree relatives of our non-remitted subjects. So is obesity, the body mass index of over 30. You'll get the theme here pretty quickly. So is urinary incontinence, so is back pain. Now, here's a surprise, and this is, again, one of these findings that we weren't expecting. Our subjects are young. They were in their early 30s at the time of this interview, and they didn't have a lot of cardiovascular disease or cancer. But when we asked them about their families, we did see some differences. And we're asking about first-degree relatives, so this includes parents. And we have more. Obviously, each of the subjects has two parents. So we got some findings here that were just astonishing, and we don't quite know what to make of them yet. Cardiovascular disease, significantly more common in the families of non-remitted subjects than remitted subjects. Okay, 53% compared to 39%. And here's another astonishing slide. The same is true of cancer. Again, we weren't particularly expecting this, but there it is, and it's something for us to really think about. If you have a borderline subject, and the borderline subject remits, that is associated with less cancer in the first degree relatives than in the families of subjects with BPD that doesn't remit. Now, again, just to repeat myself, does this reflect just growing up in a family where people make poor choices, smoke a lot, don't exercise, or is there some kind of biological vulnerability that we're completely missing here? We don't know, but this is something to really think about. Okay, so to sum up, this has been a very quick review of our first look at medical illnesses in subjects with BPD that haven't remitted. And we've come up with some, we think, very, very provocative and interesting findings. Just to repeat, failure to remit does, in fact, as has been suspected for a long time, but I think we're the first group to show this, it does seem to be associated with these strange conditions like chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, or TMG. These are strange conditions not particularly well-defined or well-understood. But there are other medical conditions which we understand very well. Hypertension, diabetes, urinary incontinence, very easy to define. And these also are associated with the failure to remit from BPD. Why is this? So far I've just told you our findings, but I haven't really thought about why this could be. Well, we have a number of circular conditions going at play here. It could be that borderline subjects who are still borderline are in such turmoil, are depressed or miserable, that they just have trouble taking care of themselves. Don't exercise, eat too much. That certainly could be it. Again, clinicians who prescribe medication for BPD may be making some of the problems worse. Our psychotropic medications, the best medications we have are the four of the best that I can just think of off the top of my head, clozapine, Depakote, lithium, Paxil, all four of those are associated with weight gain. This is another of life's unfairnesses. But medication, the better the medication is, more side effects it seems to have, and weight gain is one of them. Now, if you gain weight, it is more difficult to exercise. If you gain weight, you're more likely to have back pain. If you have back pain and if you're not exercising, you're more likely to be obese. If you're obese, it unfortunately, again, one of the unfairnesses in America, the stigma associated with obesity. If you're obese, you're going to have a poorer self-image, you're going to feel worse about yourself, your family, your friends will nag you, it'll affect your social life, you'll be more depressed, you won't exercise, you'll have back pain, you'll be obese, you'll go to your doctor will put you on lithium Paxil and maybe clozapine, and it just gets worse and worse. It's amazing, actually, that any of us are surviving, isn't it? Anyway. What I just talked about was all to do with the remitted subject, him or herself, but the situation is a little bit more complicated because we found these medical illnesses in the families of non-remitted subjects. So this is more complicated than we initially thought. Lifestyle choices, again, you're more likely to smoke if you haven't remitted from BPD, and you're more likely to use very costly forms of medical services, visiting ERs, having hospitalizations. Again, I think I've said this before, it's circular. A lot of the conditions I mentioned are to do with obesity and lack of exercise, and they in turn just make you feel worse, and that in turn makes you make worse choices. Life-threatening physical illnesses, here we're talking about diabetes, obesity, hypertension. These are not trivial points. One of the things we also have noticed anecdotally in our own practice is that sometimes our subjects seem to continue to have borderline symptomatology, but to have fewer crises. On the other hand, they're having more medical crises. So in terms of healthcare costs, we wonder if, in at least a subgroup of our subjects, if they'll be paying fewer psychiatric bills and more emergency room bills. So the cost of, we haven't talked much about this, the cost of BPD, both to the subjects and to the insurers and to the population as a whole, may shift from psychiatric to medical as our subjects get older. Okay, to conclude, I think I just really said that. Again, maybe just a plea to clinicians that as we treat our subjects, it's so easy for us to be overwhelmed by their psychiatric problems that sometimes we forget the medical problems. And I don't exactly know what the take-home message from this is, because I don't think they need more nagging from us about lifestyle choices. But if there's some way to keep it in our minds when we treat them, that we all live in our own bodies, and if your subject is suffering from urinary incontinence, back pain, and diabetes, it doesn't help them deal with their other more psychological problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Frankenberg. Well, your discussion has elicited many questions. We'll get to as many as we can. The one was, what is the definition that you're using of remit for borderline?
Remission from BPD, I hope Mary's in the audience, or not in the audience if I get this wrong. I think it's simply not meeting DSM-4 or the DIP-R criteria for BPD anymore. I can't see Mary. Is that, if that's horribly wrong, I hope she'll come up and correct me. At every interview, we administer thousands of interviews, including the revised diagnostic interview for borderlines. And we also go over DSM criteria, and once you don't meet those anymore, you're defined as remitted.
Some of the questions also related to the possibility of an abuse history, and wondered if that was, questions about abuse history were included in your investigation.
Oh, that's a difficult question. The question was about abuse. Yes, we certainly look at abuse. That's a major interest of the MSAT study. We look at that in all sorts of ways, to look at the relationships between abuse and psychological, psychiatric symptoms. I'm just trying to remember this. We haven't looked at the relationship between abuse and these medical conditions. And again, if Mary's in the audience, she might be able to answer this. We are just looking at the relationship between PTSD and obesity. But I think actually we're just beginning that, and probably we shouldn't talk about that in case we change our mind about the findings. That is an interest. It's not something that we have the final answer on yet. But probably within the next few months, we'll be coming out with something about the relationship between PTSD and at least obesity.
Then there's a question of, in patients with BPD, is the higher, what are your thoughts in terms of, is the higher family rate of CAD and cancer related to the trauma and the loss? Did you look at when these occurred in the life cycle and how they might affect the symptoms?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think we have the data to look at the relationship between cardiovascular illness and cancer to do with trauma and loss. That's an extremely interesting question, but this study won't be able to look at that.
Do you have information about how these ratios and percentages compare to the general population of the occurrence of these particular ailments?
How do these rates compare to the general populations? That sounds like a straightforward question, and when you actually try to get rates in the population, it's extremely difficult, because what we want to do is compare these rates to a group that's 80% women, 20% men, mostly Caucasian, in their early 30s, and there obviously just aren't those figures. Certainly the rates of obesity are somewhat higher than in the general population. But we don't really have a control group that matches these control groups for demographics.
Do you have information in terms of, are these results for the major mood disorders comparison groups, how it would compare with major mood disorders?
Again, that's a very good question, the comparison between this and major mood disorder. The depression is associated with an increased risk of major medical illnesses, especially cardiovascular illness. And there, by the way, there's another very interesting circular connection. The more depressed you are, the more, this is it very roughly, the more depressed you are, the more likely you are to have coronary artery disease. Coronary artery disease in itself is a huge precipitant for depression. And depression is also associated with difficulty in recovering from heart attacks. Again, we don't have a group that's comparable in demographics. And there's surprisingly little done on young groups, both with schizophrenia and depression in terms of medical illness. The studies we cited earlier were some of the major ones. And as you can see, they're not very many.
As biological vulnerabilities, are there any studies on BPD and asthma and or allergies or overuse of antihistamines or OT over-the-counter drugs?
Say that again. I missed the question.
In respect to biological vulnerabilities, are you aware of any studies on BPD and asthma and or allergies?
Again, a good question. Asthma, allergies, sensitivity to the over-the-counter medications. I'm not aware of any particular biological vulnerabilities to that, but definitely that does tend to run in families. Asthma, again, is a good example of a chronic medical illness, poorly understood, where there's clearly a genetic and an environmental component. Don't think that we found a relationship with asthma and BPD yet.
And here's a sort of a speculation one. Do you feel that poorer health in BPD patients is related in any way to clinician countertransference?
Do I think that clinician countertransference causes poor health in BPD?
No, I think it's the thought is, the question is, are they undertreated because of physician countertransference? That's what I would interpret it as being. In other words, are these people just simply not, because for some reason in their way of reacting to physicians, are physicians not stepping in as assertively as they might with other patients and taking as good medical care?
Well, I don't think clinicians in some respects are responsible for the lifestyle choices that their subjects make, except that I suppose that they should always remind them not to smoke and to exercise. Whether or not it really helps for the clinicians to constantly nag their subjects about that, I mean, obviously, my bias is that it doesn't help. And I personally feel that my patients have so many problems that me asking them every time I see them, you know, have you stopped smoking yet? Have you taken up exercise? Is not helpful. But I could be wrong. I could be wrong about that. And perhaps it's just that we need to find better ways of encouraging our subjects. And my constant use of the word nagging, perhaps that is due to countertransference. That's a good question. Yeah. Certainly the clinician does play a role in terms of medication prescription. And we do need to remember that a lot of our medications have quite significant medical comorbidity attached to them.
And here's one I'm certain that you've thought about, which is, and I think you commented somewhat, but could you not conclude that the medical issues exacerbate BPD, making it more difficult to remit
from BPD?
Yes.
You're tossing this one.
Yeah, it's very circular. Medical conditions, I think, do exacerbate BPD. On the other hand, again, it's never quite that simple. Once in a while, you get medical conditions which challenge the person and somehow lead to an improvement in their functioning. Of course, I'm thinking of one of my own patients, a Vietnam veteran, rather usual story of PTSD from childhood, PTSD from abuse as a child, exacerbated by terrible experiences in Vietnam. And then, of course, he became an alcoholic and an opiate abuser. This deals with the pain, and it also makes it worse. Also a risk taker, one of the impulsive borderlines that John was talking about, had a motor bike accident and became paraplegic from T10 down. So this is a man who's been extremely active his entire life, and he now is wheelchair bound, has a Foley catheter in, he can't pee by himself, no sex life, and has pressure sores all the time. You would think that this would not be helpful, and in fact, it's turned his life around. He no longer seems to have much borderline symptomatology. He has a group of friends, other Vietnam vets, who are extraordinarily helpful in his care. So I don't want to say that this is a good thing that's happened to him, but life is more complex than these slides would indicate. Once in a while, terrible things or terrible medical complications can somehow change people and bring out better aspects of them. Now, I'm not sure that my patient would have chosen this to happen to him. In fact, I'm sure he wouldn't have. And generally, medical illnesses really are just awful and to be avoided. Once in a while, however, unexpected things do happen.
Quite a story. Are you recommending yoga and alternative therapies, meditation rather than psychopharmacology for treatment of BPD?
Do I recommend yoga or alternative medication, alternative therapies? Possibly. For some subjects, yoga is really remarkably helpful. For those of you who've ever taken yoga groups, the yoga leader is always like a yogi. He or she always seems to have a very therapeutic approach to life and is always saying, actually, one of my favorite sayings, I was taking a yoga class and people were going through all of these postures, and every now and again you fall down. And the yoga teacher said to me at one point in a very calm, soothing voice, she said, "Now I can see you trying very hard to stand by yourself, but please remember, the wall is our friend. You can touch the wall." And I thought, wow, I was in therapy for years. This is way better. The wall is our friend. So you can get help from wherever. Yoga classes, yoga leaders really about the world's nicest people. You also get to be in a group of people who are also very nice. Everyone is supportive and speaks in low, warm voices. I'm a fan of yoga, but it's not for everyone. Once in a while, medications are very helpful also.
Back to a little bit to the statistics. Did you control for socioeconomic status since with somatic complaints there's the situation?
Did we control for socioeconomic state? This isn't in our... I think we did. Again, Mary might want to correct me, but I think we did. Not a great answer, but there it is.
Did any of the patients have stomach stapling? And if so, do you have any
stomach
response
stapling
to that? Yes.
I don't think that any of our subjects have had stomach stapling. But boy, this again is one of these complicated procedures, and I'm sure that some people benefit tremendously and some people don't.
And also statistically, why didn't you also involve stats on ordinary controls?
We don't have ordinary controls. I, I, I can see that this is a problem. I wish we did. But medical illnesses are so much affected by your demographics, obviously, mostly your age, but also gender and race. And we do not have a control group of people who are matched demographically without psychiatric illness. And by the way, it's very difficult to ever get a control group for psychiatric illnesses, because you either get super controls, people who have no psychiatric illness, whose families have no psychiatric illness, and I don't know of any person in the world who's actually like that, or you have people who lie to you. So it's difficult to get the right control group.
Do you know of any studies on antivirals that produce secondary results of disease in BPD symptoms?
Do I know of antivirals?
Any studies on antivirals that produce secondary results of diseases?
I don't.
Borderline.
No.
Okay. In terms of your looking at sleep medications, which medications were qualifying? And the author says sometimes we use Seroquel for glue, but also the side benefit for sleep. What's included in your definition of the sleep medications?
Well, we're from Massachusetts. We're very simple. We said to the subjects, do you take medications to help you sleep? And people actually take a variety of different medications to help them sleep. But if they took something specifically for sleep, and yes, we do, there's a lot of Seroquel used for that, then we counted that. But what we're getting at here is not the medication so much, but the sense that you cannot sleep by yourself without an artificial aid.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any data on headaches, especially migraines? Did that come forward?
We do have headache data, which isn't reported here. When headaches are so common that I'm not sure what our findings were. And I think we expected to find more findings with headaches than we did.
And then there's a question, it'll be the final question, which is, since so many patients remitted within a 6-year period, presumably without specific treatment, is there any concern of misdiagnosis as a baseline?
Whoa, a brave questioner. Did we misdiagnose our subjects? Well, no, we did not. This is a very, very well-defined group. This is our life work. These subjects were not misdiagnosed. And this is a major finding that Mary may be talking more about later, that as many of them seemed remitted as did. No, this is not an artifact of a misdiagnosis. This is the true blue finding.